Welcome to the Free Movement Podcast. I am Sonia Linnegan, and I'm joined as ever by my co-host, Colin Yeo. Colin, how are you today?
I'm okay, Sonia. Hi.
So this is our roundup of January. Sorry that we are quite late this month. We will do better for February's roundup. Promise. We're starting today with asylum. And the first article is one I wrote, which is reduction in asylum backlog achieved mainly through withdrawals and questionnaires. So this is looking at the government's claim to have, well, I think they said that the legacy backlog, which is cases before the 28th of June 2022, had been cleared, whereas in fact there were, I think, around 4,500 cases still outstanding. So I looked at how they had achieved that reduction in the backlog. I deliberately called it a reduction and not a clearance. It was just quite interesting. They were publishing these ad hoc statistics on a monthly basis, I think it was, and they published the last ones up to the 28th of December last year. And what the figures show is that there were a lot of decisions that seemed to be made without a substantive interview, which is obviously great news because those are grants. The statistics also show the big increase in Home Office staff, which must have had some impact. Although, I mean, the reduction in backlog seems to have mainly been achieved by withdrawals and questionnaires, which do require less caseworking than if you're interviewing someone and processing a case in full. So it's unclear the extent to which that increase in staff had an impact. It must have had some impact, but just the extent is unclear. Then, of course, there were withdrawals. Of the 112,138 decisions made last year, 35,119 of those were non-substantive decisions. So non-substantive decisions includes withdrawals. And just because of what we know historically, it seems reasonable to conclude that most of those non-substantive decisions were actually withdrawals. And that's because we can see the statistics to the end of September showed that that figure was already almost 19,000. The next statistics have been published next week, so we'll get a better idea of the extent of the withdrawals that happened last year then. The other thing they did to reduce the legacy backlog is they just didn't bother processing any of the new cases. I say new, that is cases since the 28th of June 2022, which the Home Office calls flow cases. And then I also looked at whether the new legislation had had any impact on the backlog, because obviously this is what the government is claiming, that this is what's going to stop people from coming. And it hasn't, essentially. And that brings me on to the next article, which is the inadmissibility process and the three new asylum backlogs. And I'm now operating a barter system, apparently, at Free Movement. Barry O'Leary asked me to write this article, and in exchange, he wrote one for us. It was a really useful exercise for me to set this all out, as all of these legislative changes have created such a mess. And it's just, it's all very complicated. I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail here. This is the sort of article that I think it's useful to just go and look at every time you need to think about what is happening with these cases, because it is so complex. In the article, I ignored the legacy ones and instead just looked at flow. And again, this is something that was reported in the ad hoc statistics. They were breaking down outstanding applications in three cohorts. So again, putting legacy aside, they were reporting it as 28th of June 2022 to 6 March 2023. So that is before the illegal migration bill. So that's the Nationality and Borders Act in force then. And then 7th March 2023 to 19th of July, that's illegal migration bill. And then 20th of July onwards, which is Illegal Migration Act cohort. I don't know. They seem to have stopped publishing the ad hoc statistics, and that breakdown does not exist in the quarterly statistics, I think. So I'm not sure if we're going to keep getting those numbers. I mean, voluntarily, obviously, they can be FOI'd. Anyway, so that aside, this article, I just look at the size of the backlog for each of those cohorts, look at the legal framework, and then what might or should happen next. That is that one. Yeah, Colin, on to you next.
Thanks, Sonia. So I think I have got a quick mention for a High Court case on age assessment. And this was a write-up by Bilal Shabir, one of our sort of semi-regular contributors. It's nice and concise. And it's kind of every judicial review advocate's nightmare, where you appear in front of Mr. Justice Fordham KC, who, you know, literally wrote the book on judicial review. And if you're going to play fast and loose with the procedures, then he's not really the guy to do it with. And he makes a few very polite, concise comments about the importance of submitting your skeleton arguments on time. In this case, it was the respondent, I think it was a local authority, or at least telling them that you're going to be submitting it later, because he makes some points about judicial pre-reading, where they actually don't necessarily, judges don't necessarily pre-read the day before. They may well pre-read several days in advance. And when they do their pre-reading, they really want everything to be there, so that they can decide, you know, whether they're actually going to do the pre-reading then or later or whatever. There's also some useful stuff on the substance. It's an age assessments challenge. And in this particular case, the local authority hadn't really done a proper minded to process. They'd already made their mind up, and they just kind of told the person that's not really an open-minded minded to process. And also some comments on the importance of not attaching too much weight just to physical characteristics to actually do a sort of full in the round Merton compliant assessment. So yeah, useful case, short write-up, and it's well worth a quick look if you are doing age assessment cases. We've got a couple of cases, a couple of blog posts to cover here. So Francesca Seller has done a short briefing on evidence and arguments in asylum claims based on gender-based violence. And it's a useful summary of some of the sort of pitfalls that you might face, different potential solutions to those and approaches that you might adopt. So I sort of highly recommend having a look at that in terms of how to prepare and think about gender-based violence asylum claims. And then I think literally it was later the same week, the CJEU, the Court of Justice of the European Union, came out with a big case on gender-based violence claims and particular social group. Now, it was our very own Jasmine who wrote this one up. And as she says at the end, this does matter in the UK. It's not directly binding. CJEU stuff like this isn't directly binding, but it is influential for two reasons. One is because the Nationality and Borders Act actually effectively adopts EU law, or what EU law was at the time that it was passed, or the same words of EU law. And secondly, it's influential anyway, where you've got an international court making sort of pronouncements on things and interpreting international law, then other courts will look to that, particularly as here, where the judgment is based on international conventions to which the UK is also party. So the CEDAW and also the Istanbul Protocol. So some good points to make there. I mean, I think it'd be fair to say that a UK practitioner judge would be pretty surprised by the initial outcome of this one, where I think it's a Bulgarian case, and the court originally dismissed and refused the case for reasons that you wouldn't be likely to see in the UK. But nevertheless, it's useful confirmation that women as a whole may be regarded as belonging to a particular social group where it's established that they are exposed to physical and mental violence, including sexual and domestic violence, in their country of origin on account of their gender. So, you know, useful things that we're pretty familiar with in the UK, but also helpful on the cumulative test. Now, this is a bit obscure. I don't want to go into detail too much on this, but it's the kind of different approaches to defining particular social group. And it's that the legislation now in the EU and also the UK requires you to show not only that you've got some sort of special characteristic, but also that you're identified as being a member of a group socially. And this confirms that cumulative approach, under that cumulative approach, women can still be identified as a particular social group, which is handy.
So next one is another one that I wrote, and this is the Home Secretary's unlawful secret policy to withhold leave to remain from victims of modern slavery. So the case is XYN, Secretary of State for the Home Department, and basically the Home Secretary decided not to comply with the judgment in KTT. And that is a case that said that people who have been recognized as a victim of trafficking and who have a pending asylum claim where trafficking is part of that should be granted leave. So Home Secretary decided not to comply with that, did not apply for a stay on the decision, didn't tell anyone about the decision not to comply, and then lied repeatedly when challenged on it. And they would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for that pesky Alison Pickup and the amazing team at Asylum Aid, who did just like great evidence gathering on this and managed to uncover it all. This is a long article, but I just think it's so interesting, especially just the horrifying conduct by the Home Office in this case. I have also promised a separate post on the duty of candor because there were issues with that, quite obviously, in this case. That one is coming, but the duty of candor decisions keep coming as well. There have been, I think, at least two more since this one, criticizing the Home Secretary for the same thing. So I'm just in the process of gathering my thoughts, and then I will get stuck into that one.
Yeah, I look forward to your duty of candor stuff
because it's just rant.
Oh, yeah, well, and the sort of litigation conduct at the Home Office.
Yeah.
I think I don't know how far it's fair to say this, and that'd be interesting to see your take on it. I think mainly by the Home Office rather than GLD, although there's some question marks about GLD conduct as well. GLD stands for Government Legal Department. So yeah, there's been quite a few cases like this, haven't there, as you say?
Yeah, a real run of them recently. Just appalling.
Yeah.
And not just the Home Office either.
I think you were saying, like, somebody'd said, are you going to write up that case on Home Office litigation misconduct?
Yeah.
And you were like, oh, which one? You pick.
I was hysterical. I was like, you're going to have to be more specific.
Oh, dear. Right. Okay. Moving quickly on then. So I'd give a quick mention to a concession for applicants on the Hong Kong BNO route. And the basic, the long and short of this is that normally, if you're already in the UK in breach of immigration laws, you're not allowed to switch into this route. But a concession has been announced for, let me get this right, people who are on immigration bail or have withdrawn their asylum claim. So that's the short story and pretty much the long story. Take a look at that post if you need more details.
Next, we're on to business immigration. And Colin, you're covering a couple of very, very popular articles on care home sponsor license.
Have these had a lot of interest? I haven't checked the stats for a while, actually. Is these ones getting hammered on the stats front? Right, interesting.
Everyone's interested, yeah.
Well, they're two contrasting cases. They came out within quite a short time of each other. And in one of them, the care home operator loses their license, basically. And in the other case, the care home operator keeps their license. And the sort of short story, I guess, is that the guys who lose their license were alleged or were found to have committed multiple breaches, basically, of the terms of their license. They had a lot more skilled workers, I think 220 nearly, compared to about 60 or 70, I think, for the other one. And there were multiple breaches. And ultimately, the court concluded that it was lawful to withdraw the license. Of course, remember, the consequences of withdrawing the license are not just bad for the care home operator, who then can't employ anybody from overseas, but it's also very, very bad news for those employees who basically lose their leave, having potentially spent a lot of money on application fees and so on through no fault of their own because of poor conduct by the care home operator. They're suddenly, without any immigration status, which is very, very bad indeed. In some ways, then, the most interesting one is the one where the care home operator actually succeed in their application for judicial review. So this is Supporting Care Limited, and the reference is 2024 EWHC 68 Admin. And let's see, there were nearly 70 sponsored workers, and there was basically that the Home Office raised, I think, 6 compliance breaches. These have both been written up by Jack Freeland, which is useful having sort of somebody look at two similar cases, having the same author looking at two cases. And Jack says that by the time the substantive hearing comes along, the area of dispute had been whittled down to just one employee, so one out of 68 sponsored workers. And the issue is that the Home Office guidance says that it is mandatory that revocation take place where the role doesn't match the job description. And in this case, the employee was found not to be required to do, I think, 2 of the 8 duties listed on the certificate of sponsorship. So it's a fairly minor breach for that employee. And also, it's only one employee out of nearly 70. But nevertheless, Home Office policy is that withdraw the license, termination of the license is mandatory. And the court finds that, well, actually, there is some discretion and the Home Office has to act in a rational way. They have to look at all of the circumstances and that it wasn't proportionate, wasn't lawful in this case to withdraw. So, yeah, it's quite an interesting outcome, but it's just if you're reading these cases, just bear in mind how vulnerable those employees are for things that are completely beyond their own control. It's quite chastening, I think, when you see it that way.
Okay, the next article is one looking at more flexibility for business visitors, and the immigration rules changed on the 31st of January to create some flexibility to the permitted work-related activities that visitors can undertake when they come here. And those changes were primarily aimed at those conducting business in the UK. And the article just sets out the changes. They've been made to intra-corporate activities, remote working, flight crew, scientists, academic and researchers, legal professionals, and permitted paid engagements. So those are all explained in there. Next is you, because I know you like ranting about this.
I don't want to get started too much because it's just, yeah, it just drives me nuts. So this is, you've landed me with the dates for the changes to the income thresholds for family and skilled worker visas. So, you know, we're recording this on the 22nd of February, and on the 19th of February, the Home Office was parading its ban on overseas care workers bringing their families to the UK, but it's only being laid. It actually comes into force on the 11th of March, so not yet. And then the 14th of March, we're seeing a new statement of changes. Again, it's being laid. It's not coming into force straight away, and that's for partners applying under Appendix FM. And that's going to increase the minimum income requirement from the 18,600 it is at the moment to 29,000. And that's with effect from the 11th of April. In theory, it's going to go up in the future. If there's a change of government, that seems unlikely to happen. I'm not sure it'll happen, even if the government, by some miracle, was actually to win the election, because it's just so nuts, basically. But there we go.
I wonder if there will be any horrible surprises in that next statement of changes, just like there were in this week's one. I guess we wait and find out. The next one that we're looking at is tax residents in the UK. When do people become liable for income and capital gains tax? So John Vassiliou suggested a short series of articles on various tax-related things that can arise when you move or spend a lot of time in the UK, or even just buy property here. I have to say, I mean, I'm a migrant myself, and I find all of this very annoying because I needed this like over 20 years ago. And I'm like, this would have been so handy to have all in one place when I first moved here and was trying to figure out what on earth, like how everything works. Anyway, people now can read them and find them very useful. Do share with clients, etc. Next, I'm just going to mention briefly an article we published on Appendix Children. It looks at which routes it applies to and what are the requirements. And this is part of this whole simplification process that they have rolled out this appendix, and it's been applied to more and more routes, mainly student and work routes. So this article just summarizes which routes it applies to and how to navigate the requirements. Next, it is on to detention.
Thanks, Sonia. So I'm covering the first case, and this is IS Bangladesh against Secretary of State for the Home Department, and there's two different judgments. You can see the citations on the blog post if you want to. It's called High Court Grants Bail to Person Detained Under New Illegal Migration Act Powers. We don't always write up every detention case in the High Court because sometimes they're very sort of fact-specific and there's not much to sort of learn from them. This one's a bit different. I mean, the facts are a bit astonishing, I think, actually, without even looking at the legal significance of it. This is somebody who'd been detained continuously for 28 months, 2016 to 2018. He'd committed some further offences and was being detained again. But when you've detained somebody for 28 months and haven't managed to remove them in that time, you know, it does beg the question of how you think it's going to be different second time around and so on. The legal significance, though, of this case is that it took place, or the detention takes place, after the commencement of new detention powers in the Illegal Migration Act 2023, which basically mean that the Home Secretary is now responsible for establishing whether detention is reasonable. It's the Secretary of State's view of reasonableness of detention that now matters, rather than the judge's view, essentially, of reasonableness. class. So it changes the kind of quality of review, as a lawyer would say. This case is quite helpful for saying that that doesn't mean that the Home Secretary can simply just get away with detaining people when the Home Secretary wants to. The Home Secretary is constrained by their own policies, for example, and human rights law might well be relevant as well, with breaches of Article 5 of the European Convention on Human Rights potentially being relevant. So in this case, the court looked at all of the circumstances and concluded that even on the Secretary of State's own, even on the Home Office's own policies, detention wasn't lawful for multiple reasons here. You know, he was a very vulnerable detainee, and the length of detention was already significant, and so on. So yeah, it's a useful case, and it's going to be quite an important one for people to be referencing, I think, if they are doing detention cases. Although, you know, we may well see more from the higher courts at some point in the future.
The next detention one is mine, and that is High Court quashes Home Office policy of delaying release of vulnerable detainees to get a second medical opinion. This is part of the Home Office's very, very long-running war on medico-legal reports, and that some of that was set out in detail in an article in December by Beth Mullen-Farrows on safeguards in immigration detention. Anyway, in this case, the High Court allowed a judicial review. It was brought by Medical Justice, and they were challenging the Home Office policy of seeking a second medical opinion where a medico-legal report has been submitted in support of a person who is vulnerable in immigration detention. So essentially, where a detainee submitted an external medical report produced by an independent medical professional which showed that they were vulnerable to harm in immigration detention, the Home Office could, under this policy, then seek their own second opinion from one of their doctors. Where second opinions were sought by the Home Office, this was delaying consideration of the evidence in those cases, and obviously then it prolongs detention by several weeks or more. So the court held that the policy contradicted the adults at risk policy and was unlawful on that basis. And then another issue was the fact that the policy was introduced without any form of consultation. And this was contrary to established practice of consulting with medical justice and other expert interested groups. I've been in these meetings before, so this is just giving me some PTSD. The court held that the failure to consult was unlawful, and the policy has been withdrawn, but I expect that the Home Office will seek to introduce it lawfully in future. That seems the most likely outcome of this. Just they have a real bee in their bonnet about this issue. But in the meantime, people who have had the second opinion policy applied to them since it was introduced in June 2022 may have a claim for unlawful detention based on application of the unlawful policy. So if you have someone who is in that situation, then do go and read this article.
Yeah. You do wonder about the sort of thinking at the Home Office, because they, you're absolutely right there, and they clearly have a real bee in their bonnet about this. But it's like, well, if you follow through why they don't like medical opinions, and it's presumably because it stops people from being detained, but why are they detaining people anyway? Because they're not removing them. They're sort of just detaining them for fun, essentially, or something. It's kind of just purposeless immigration detention. Yeah, I don't know. They just need saving from themselves. Anyway, I'm supposed to be talking about family immigration and a lovely article by, well, lovely, a very good article by Barry O'Leary from Wesley Grick on how to avoid the minimum income requirement for partners under Appendix FM. And he looks at the different options that are available for how to try and sort of deal with the coming increase, basically. So option one is get your application in before the change takes place, basically. So make the formal application before the date. I think it was the 11th of April, did I say earlier? I think it was the 11th of April. And he also points us to a useful article by Alex Paletska about application dates and biometrics and things like that. So that's a useful read as well. Barry talks about a paragraph EX1 in Appendix FM and how that might be used, the sort of 7 years rule where you've got a British child or a child who's lived in the UK for 7 years, and it wouldn't be reasonable for the child to leave the UK, insurmountable obstacles to family life continuing in another country. Although he absolutely rightly says at the end of the article, you know, that is not a straightforward test. What one person considers to be insurmountable obstacles aren't necessarily what the Home Office or a judge consider to be insurmountable obstacles. Also talks about the exceptional circumstances for broadening the sources that can be used, which is arguably slightly easier route to sort of meeting the minimum income requirement, but by using sources that aren't normally listed in Appendix FMSE, or the exemption where the sponsoring partner is in receipt of certain welfare benefits. There's a section in the article on just the importance of making strong initial applications, because it's very hard to correct things later, or impossible to correct things later, basically. So it's a really useful article. And Barry has very kindly agreed to deliver some training for us on in April, coming up in April, on the 24th, I think it is, 24th of April, 2024?
Yeah, on the 24th of April. If there isn't already one in there, I'll make sure that there is a link in that article to the training, and I'll also put it in the description for this podcast. But yeah, so that is Barry giving a webinar on exceptional circumstances in these Appendix FM applications, and that will be absolutely brilliant because Barry is great.
He is. So yeah, if you're interested in these issues, wanting to sort of think about how to deal with this coming change, then do have a look at Barry's blog post, and also think about signing up for the 1 hour webinar as well.
Next, it is on to the EU settlement scheme, and I'm just going to mention this one briefly. The article is Changes to Treatment of Some Late Applications to the EU Settlement Scheme in New Guidance. I mean, this is really the most begrudging change. It is essentially for people who hold permanent residence and are applying late, of whom there are still stories coming out regularly that people just were not aware, because they already have this thing saying you have permission to stay here permanently. These changes in the guidance are the smallest possible concession to the problems that people are having with late applications. They have essentially added a couple of examples to the guidance of where a person will have reasonable grounds for not knowing they needed to apply earlier. And they've also added some relevant factors that include where a person had a permanent residence document and has not applied to the EU settlement scheme previously. They are still not making things very straightforward for this group, for reasons best known to the Home Office, because they are not going to be removing these people.
And again, it's nuts, because I can see why you, in the run up to a deadline like that, you can't say, oh, don't worry, no, we won't be applying this after the deadline anyway, because then people won't bother to apply. You need to make it sound like you're going to be serious about it, to try and focus people's attention, get, you know, everybody communicating about this and sort of take it seriously and so on. But after the deadline, it just makes no sense. And makes no sense to be so harsh to EU citizens. And it doesn't help the Home Office. It gets them all sorts of bad media attention, which they obviously care a lot about. It's just such bad policy, making people unlawful, but also not even trying to remove them or anything. It's really bad idea. So yeah, it's just despair.
And yeah, it was apparently a bizarro response to claiming that there was abuse of the certificate of application process. I mean, maybe just make decisions faster then. Like, this is not the response. Anyway, we are where we are. This is a story that is obviously going to keep rumbling along. Finishing up today, just a couple of articles that we updated last month that I want to flag up. The first one is a briefing on the duty to safeguard children in need and their families at Section 17 of the Children Act 1989. That's one of our articles that's consistently looked at by quite a lot of people. And this is taken from Project 17. They work to support people who are in receipt of Section 17, and they are just brilliant. And so this briefing is by them. And then the second one is, what are the immigration rules for settled returning residents of the UK? And that one has just been updated to take into account changes to the immigration rules. And that's it. I don't think we have anything particular to finish on by way of a good news story this month. I guess, I don't know if Dave is still listening. Now it's not part of his job anymore, but if you do want to come onto the podcast and spill the beans, then do feel free.
That'd be brilliant. Okay, on that note, bye everybody, and we'll be back. Well, it's so late in the month, we'll actually be back fairly soon, probably in the next week or so.
Yes, we will. Yeah.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye.